Okay, good afternoon. So today we're going to talk about a completely different topic from everything we did before, which is stack smashing. But first, we'll try to finish up the old stuff. So as you know, there's an assignment due on Friday. Hopefully you know this. Any questions about that assignment generally? Everyone happy or hasn't looked at it? Yeah. The question is, on the exam, are we going to have you do the things we had you do on the assignments? And the answer is quite possibly yes, though we will do it in a way which does not involve you needing to look things up that aren't listed on the exam, and that is actually like plausible to grade. Like, we probably do not want to read handwritten machine code in grading of like more than like 6 bytes. So if you have to like write machine code or read machine code, we will give you the full information that you would find in the manual that is relevant in some format. Probably just by saying, this is how this instruction is encoded for each of the instructions that we care about. Okay. And I guess that gives us to the second point. So there's an exam in 1 week, which I can't spell apparently. And Monday is the review for that. If you don't have questions, it will be a very short class. So the last few times we were covering techniques for writing malware and for combating malware. And these are two interconnected topics because many of the techniques that malware authors were using were because of how people tried to combat malware. And the biggest thing was around avoiding sort of pattern-based detection techniques. These sort of techniques where we either looked at the code or the behavior of the code or tried to figure out what the code did in some way. And malware authors wanted to make that harder. So they did things like encrypted the code, they made the code change so we couldn't look for something in particular, and they tried to make it harder to do things where we'd run the code in a controlled environment like a debugger or a VM. And they also had other techniques about hiding the operation of the code from telltale signs like, oh, there's a malicious executable here in my file system by changing what those calls do, and by also looking for antivirus software, which is looking for bad behavior. So any questions on any of these topics before we abandon them? Probably not. So today we're going to talk about vulnerabilities and exploits. And if you recall, vulnerabilities in programs, when I talk about a software vulnerability, this is unintended behavior that an adversary can use to do something that they want to use that shouldn't be possible. And the most common, well, most obviously dangerous kind of vulnerability is being able to run in whatever code you like. That's generally not something programs are supposed to let you do. Some are, like the Python command prompt is supposed to let me run whatever code I like. But a web server is not supposed to let me, as a web browser, run whatever code I like on the web server. And whether something is an exploit or not means you need to know what the program is supposed to do. To know whether there's a vulnerability or not. So vulnerabilities are these holes for which you have to know that, the program isn't supposed to let you do that. And we're going to talk about exploits versus vulnerabilities. So an exploit is using a vulnerability to do something. So we're going to look at a particular class of vulnerabilities, a broad category of vulnerabilities, and a particular method for producing exploits for them today. Doesn't mean that's the only way to produce exploits for these vulnerabilities, or the only form they'll have. And we'll, in fact, talk about other ones later in the semester. And we have mentioned at the very beginning of the class that there are lots of types of vulnerabilities. And the ones we're talking about today are the ones we'll talk about most prominently in this class are memory safety bugs. So we're going to look at a particular kind of memory safety problem. Something where you're using pointers wrong in C, if you're writing it in C, that lets adversaries do things that they're definitely not supposed to do. There are other types of bugs which are arguably as important, like injection bugs, where we have some sort of command thing that the user can put something in which is supposed to not be part of the command, just supposed to be a string in the command, but ends up being part of the command. And we have things like integer overflow and underflow, and oversights like not checking whether someone's trying to access a file that they're not supposed to access, just not checking. Not doing synchronization properly, letting something change from under you and not realizing it changed. We'll talk about at least some of these later in the semester. And the reason that these go with malware is that especially vulnerabilities that let you run whatever code you like are a great way for malware to spread. Ordinarily, when we've talked about viruses, this is about trick the user into copying this program, or have them copy this program, or this other file where we usually execute code from. It's much easier if you can execute code when the user's not expecting code to execute. When you open up a PDF document, you don't expect that to run an executable on your computer. But if there's a vulnerability in your PDF reader, maybe that could happen. And so this is generally more effective than just relying on users copying executables around. And you may remember that the Morris worm, we talked about this worm which spread between systems, and it didn't spread by sending emails to users saying, please run me. It spread by using vulnerabilities in software that was running on servers on the internet at the time. And there were two vulnerabilities it primarily used. It also spread in a different way, which was just accessing servers the user was supposed to access. So those weren't vulnerabilities. That's just taking advantage of what the user could do. But they had to use these two vulnerabilities that allowed it to spread to systems where the user it was running as wasn't allowed to do things. So one of them, it was one of those injection bugs in a program called SendMail, which was the most common mail sending and receiving program at the time. It was just used to receive mail on servers. And the other was an overflow in a program called FingerD. So FingerD was a service for looking up info about a user. So if you wanted to know who's John at MIT, what's his phone number, how do I contact him, this was a service you would use at the time. Note that this is 1988. Search engines weren't really a thing. The web wasn't really a thing. This was really a way you would actually look up information. And the way this exploit worked is that there was a 512-byte buffer that FingerD read its input into, and the Morris worm sent 536 bytes. And by very carefully constructing these 536 bytes, it managed to use this mechanism to spread itself, to execute arbitrary code, and that code would load it on that machine. Yes? So we will talk about this technique today. This is the topic for today. Exactly where it went. Yeah. So the question is, we're not tricking users into opening executables. What are we talking about doing? So in the case of this buffer overflow in FingerD, we are connecting to the Finger service, which we are supposed to be able to do. We're supposed to be able to ask, who's John at MIT? And we're sending not John, we're not saying, I want to know who John at MIT is. We're saying, I want to know who, and some way, way long string that is very carefully constructed. And that causes arbitrary code to execute. So it's an interface that we're supposed to have that's letting us do things that we're not supposed to do. And an example with a more typical user case is that, let's say I gave you a PDF document. You don't think PDF documents are supposed to let me run arbitrary programs on your machine. But if there was a vulnerability in your PDF reader, which has happened in the past, that might happen. So that's the distinction. Like, I might be tricking you into open the PDF document, but you legitimately think PDF documents aren't supposed to let people that do arbitrary things to my machine. They aren't supposed to be able to delete my files, for example. Okay. So we'll go over how this sort of exploit was constructed today. That's going to be our main topic. It's a technique called stack smashing. But first, some general words about buffer overflows. So there's lots of kinds of ways of exploiting buffer overflows and different kinds of vulnerabilities in buffer overflows. Zor, our pseudo textbook, divides these into three generations. I'm not sure that's not a precise line, but there's been some evolution. So the technique we're talking about today is probably the oldest one. And there's some other techniques, which are more sophisticated, that we will learn about later, which work in more cases and handle some things that people did in response to the technique we'll learn about today. So there's some simple fixes, including something which was the correct answer to one of the tricky questions in the RE homework, which are meant to deal with this problem. a possible correct answer, I should say. There's other ways of answering questions. So our pattern is that we're going to cause the program to write past the end of the buffer. So it's going to write into memory that's not part of the buffer. So there's some memory that doesn't belong to the buffer. And when this happens, what you're used to happening is a segfault or nothing. So our attacker is somehow going to make this actually cause some other code to run instead of segfaulting or doing nothing. And usually the attacker will try to make code that the attacker wrote end up running. And to do this, we have to know like what's in that space past the buffer. Yeah. There are multiple places it could be held. So the question is, where is the buffer held? And I've been deliberately vague about it. So there are multiple places the buffer could be, and depending on where it is, we'll need a different technique to exploit it. So as you might guess from the name of the technique we're talking about, stack smashing, we are going to talk about how we exploit buffers on the stack. This does not mean that buffers that are not on the stack aren't exploitable. We just need a different technique for that, which we will talk about probably considerably later in the semester. Yeah.
How does the attacker know where the buffer is going to be?
So the question is, how does the attacker know where the buffer is going to be? So in the case of FingerD here, FingerD was a popular program. Everyone had a copy. So the attacker just has a copy of the program. They can look at the program. They can see how it allocates memory. And you know, in fact, they can compile it in the exact same way they know it's going to be compiled and look at that machine code, see how it allocates the stack and all that. Yeah. We will go into that. And the big reason we're talking about buffer overflows is that until quite recently, they were the most common type of vulnerability in software and also the most commonly exploited. This is no longer true because now web vulnerabilities that have to do with how websites are supposed to let information be shared between other websites and things like that became more common. But until very recently, these were like, by a big margin, like 70-80% or something of vulnerabilities. Yeah.
So they haven't really gone down, they've just been surpassed.
They have gone down, but and been replaced by other things. Part of this has to do probably less with people being better at writing the sort of code that does this than people using languages which tend to not let you overflow a buffer for things which are more important. So we're going to talk about stack smashing. So this is the original and the most common form of exploiting a buffer overflow. And as I hinted on earlier, it works for buffers on the stack. And this technique is very nice because it, in fact, especially when it was originally made, worked for most buffers on the stack. Like, all you need to know is that there's a buffer on the stack and you could do this pretty much all the time. That's less true today because of things specifically done to avoid this, But unless you're taking specific countermeasures, this technique is going to work basically for any buffer you put on the stack. You're going to be able to use this technique to turn that into a way where you, if you overflow that buffer, you can run arbitrary code. Yeah?
Isn't the real problem unsanitized input, though, not like having a buffer on the
stack? We will talk about that, hopefully, if we get time. So the question is, isn't the real problem unsanitized input and not that we can go over the end of the buffer? And maybe not as much as you think. Yeah? So a buffer is, so the question is, what is a buffer? That's a good question. So a buffer is like an array. So we have went to have some place, for example, to put a line of input we're reading. And we'll call it a buffer because it's temporary storage, but it's an array on the stack. In this case, maybe not always on the stack. Sometimes it would be malloc or something like that. And probably the most influential piece of writing on stack smashing is this article from FRAC issue 49. FRAC is a magazine which is part of the non-traditional literature in that it's probably written as much for people doing bad things as people doing good things. Written by Alf One, which is a pseudonym for Elias Levy, called Smashing the Stack for Fun and Profit. It's apparently a very well-regarded article. It's very complete. It's not written for 64-bit because it was written in 1996. But it goes through everything, and it was very popular. And I point that out because maybe you want to see, this is basically the big history of this technique. So the technique existed before this because the Morris worm was using it in 88, but this is apparently generally considered the first good published description of how to do this in general. Okay, so let's talk about what buffer overflows on the stack look like. So here's an example of some code with a buffer. And we read something in from standard in using scanf, and then we do something with it. So this buffer has 100 characters. So what happens if I input 1,000 characters? What's going to happen? So it's going to overflow. So what is that going to do? Yes?
This is like a display thing it should intuitively learn.
So it puts it all on the stack. So it's going to put that all on the stack. And what's going to be the effect of that?
Is
what? Sorry?
So you
think it's going to go past the stack pointer and go into the heap, okay. Other opinions on what's going to happen? Yeah?
You can use it to correct return addresses.
So it's going to corrupt our return address. So what's that going to do?
You can point it to your own.
Wait, so I'm just, okay, yeah. So let's do, yeah, so corrupt the return address. So that's something that can happen. And in fact, that's the first thing which is going to happen here. So I have a file with 1,000 A's, just 1,000 copies of the letter A. And I run this code, inputting that file. And this is what happens. You've probably seen this message before somewhere. And what happened is, in fact, that we overwrote a return value. So let's run this in GDB. So we run it in GDB, and we run 1,000 A's. And we say, oh, you segfaulted at vulnerable at the end, at this, right where it returns. And if I look at the backtrace, it looks kind of funny. Somehow we have lots of this funny 61 address. And the question is 61 the character A? And yes, it is. So if we look at the assembly of vulnerable, what it's doing is that we have our buffer on the stack, which is RSP, after we allocate 120 bytes. And you thought we were going past the stack pointer, but on x86, the stack grows towards lower addresses. So when we go past the end of a buffer, we're going beyond, not past the stack pointer, but in the opposite direction. We're going towards the stack frame of the function which called this function. So we allocated the 120 bytes by subtracting from RSP and used that pointer as the thing we passed to scanf. Then we called do something with, then we deallocated that and tried to return. And return is popping a return address off the stack. And that return address ends up being something that scanf wrote. So, exercise. So what does the stack look like when scanf is running? So what's at the stack pointer when scanf is running? About there. Sorry, the So the first thing is that we're going to have a return address for scanf, and then that's at the lowest memory address when we just enter scanf. And what's above that? So you're saying the return address for vulnerable? Well, not quite, because vulnerable adjusted the stack pointer. Yeah. So you think that the stored base pointer would be there. And it is common to push the base pointer on the stack. That's a common pattern, but that is not one that this code does. So this code doesn't save the base pointer. Yeah. Yes, so it's subtracting 120 bytes of space for a 100 byte buffer.
So is that where all the A's end up?
What?
Is that where all the A's?
So that's where all the A's end up. We're stepping ahead. So, yeah. So we subtract 120 bytes from RSP, and we pass the value of RSP as RSI, which is, remember, one of the arguments to scanf. So that's the address of our buffer. And note that our buffer was 100 bytes, but we actually allocate 120 bytes. That's okay. We've allocated some, the compiler decided to allocate some extra space for some reason. This is not why. I think the question is, why did the compiler do this? Is it to protect against this attack? No. First of all, it doesn't. Secondly, probably it's because the compiler wants the stack to be at a multiple of a certain address. I'm not entirely sure, though. But anyways, the compiler subtracts that and copies the string, the string to the args, and then sets EAX to 0, and then calls scanf. So the stack, so at the top, at the stack pointer, just before we call, is the buffer, 100 bytes, and there's 20 bytes we aren't using, and then the return address are vulnerable. So that's what's on the stack. Yes.
So I was a little confused by when you said that it's not gonna, like the buffer, like the overflow won't go down.
Mm-hmm.
You said it like will go up, right? And it would corrupt the return address for vulnerable or the return address for scanf.
So I need to correct these slides a bit. But so here the return address, the buff, this is higher addresses. So we're going to start writing the buffer here and keep going up. So it's going to corrupt the return address for vulnerable. It's not going to corrupt the return address for scanf, which is going to be at a lower address than the buffer. And this is because of the way that the stack grows in x86.
So if the buffer grows from lower addresses to higher addresses, but since the stack grows to lower addresses, it's kind of going up.
Because the stack, the buffer goes from lower to higher. Yeah. And I need to correct something about empty slides, which I should have noticed earlier. So this is the direction our stack grows here. And so what's going to happen when we write in the buffer is that we're going to write the character for A, which is 6-1, and we're going to keep going. We're going to go past the end of the buffer into that unused space. We're going to write 6-1, 6-1, 6-1, and then we're going to write over this return address. And the return address is going to become that 6-1, 6-1, 6-1, 6-1 pattern. And that's why we got a crash, because we did this, and then we got all the way through the function, and then returned. And pardon me doing fixing my slide snippet, I thought. So our trick, of course, is going to be that we don't want to overwrite the return address with just 6-1, 6-1, 6-1, but we want to overwrite it with something more useful. So note that, that 6-1, 6-1, 6-1 also explains why we got that strange stack trace. So what our debugger was doing is it was looking at what was on the stack and said, okay, here's a return address. So wherever I am now, whatever function I'm in, I return to that address 6-1, 6-1, 6-1. And I don't know what that function is, but I'm going to guess that it has a return address right on the stack. And that's better. Sorry about this. I didn't make my slides the correct width, and that's why things were cut off. This is not on version. So we'll keep going. So we have these 6-1s above. So when we look above the stack, we have another return address is what the debugger is guessing. So the debugger's guessing, oh, there's a return address above that, and one above that, and one above that, and it keeps reading that until it runs out of space. So that's why my debugger said, oh my, you called 111 times. Which probably, in fact, matches how much we wrote. Yeah?
So
the question is, what is this double question mark in the debugger output? That means that the debugger doesn't know what function that is. It's because, it's not anywhere in the executable, right? It looked up in the executable, what's the name of this, what's the name of the function which has code at this address? And didn't find it, unsurprisingly. Yes, back there. So the debugger is just guessing, okay, I don't know what function this is, but I'm gonna guess what its stack frame looks like. And I'm going to guess that it just stores a return address, because I know it definitely does that, at least. Another option the debugger would have is it could say, you're at this address, and then I don't know what happened. But it didn't decide to do that. It decided to try to give us more information, hoping that we would be able to figure something out from this. Yeah. If this was a function, the return address would be on the stack somewhere. It's going to be one of these things. The debugger doesn't actually know that it's the next one, but it's showing us the next one just guessing. Yeah, question? So the segmentation fault happened because when we were trying to use this return address, the first one, which is really the return address for this function, that's the one that the debugger didn't have to guess, because it can actually look up the debug information and say, oh, this function stores its return address exactly here. And that, when it tried to run the return instruction there, it failed. So I have a slide for this. We have this ret queue instruction is exactly where we crashed. So you were trying to run in this ret queue, and this ret tried to jump to this address. And that's where the set fault happened. That was the memory we were trying to access that was invalid, and that turned into a seg fault because of how our operating system worked. So the trick to actually exploit this as a vulnerability rather than just a way to make the program crash is to make sure that we don't put an invalid address there. We want this return instruction to not crash. So our question is going to be, what if it wasn't invalid? And our trick is going to be that we're going to put an address in there which is valid. In fact, we're going to put an address in there which points to some part of the buffer. So by making it point to some part of the buffer, that means that when we return, we'll return to run the code in the buffer, which is stuff we wrote. So this is an example of the attacker writing code they wrote from the program that wasn't supposed to run their code. So we'll say, let's say our buffer is on this address on the stack. This is a real address you might see in the stack, so on Linux. So we'll say it's at that address. And that points to somewhere in this buffer. And that's the machine code the attacker runs. So to construct the attack, first we want to make sure that wherever the return address ends up being relative to the buffer, that part of the input we supply has this value that points to the buffer. And second, we want that part of the buffer to contain the machine code we want to run. So we're going to return not to a normal function, but to the stack. Yes?
So the way the machine code for the attacker run that, how that got into the buffer was like what we did.
So the question is, how did this machine code get into the buffer? So remember that the way this is happening is that we have code like this. The application is helpfully reading its input and putting it in the buffer for us. So there was no injection. We just chose what to put there. And we just chose to input machine code. We didn't have to do anything funny. We didn't have to look at what the code looked like. We just had to know where the return address was to point to that and what to make it point to. So, yeah.
So the virus writer just somehow find a way to put machine code in the buffer, but it overflows?
So, yeah. So what this means is that our input is this machine code followed by some filler if we need it, followed by this address. That's what we input to the program. Yes?
So in order to implement this, we would need to know exactly what the compiler is compiling to the program, right? Like we would need to know that it's giving, like that it's doing this 20 byte unused space and that like this is exactly where it is.
So the question is, in order to do this, don't we need to know exactly what the stack layout looks like? And at this point, it looks like yes. So we'll have some things we can do later which make us have to be a little less precise. But for now, we really want to know basically exactly how the stack looks, at least. And we know that that can vary between like compilers, maybe compiler options. So it's pretty sensitive. But once we have a target program, we can certainly do this. So basically, our procedure here is we're going to write some machine code to execute. It's often called shell code. This is the term you'll see, because often the thing that people would do with this is run a shell. A command prompt, that is. So they could send things to that command prompt and then do whatever they want. And it's easy to write a little bit of code which starts a shell. And this is, in fact, what the Morris worm did. The Morris worm had some code which started the shell, and that shell was hooked up to the same input, so it sent the buffer overflow, which started the shell, then it sent commands in the shell to load it, a copy of itself on that system. So once you write the shell code, you put that in your buffer, and then you insert in the appropriate place in the buffer the address you want to put, the return address that will point to the buffer. And you make sure it's long enough, the thing you're sending as input is long enough that that will happen. So let's start by talking about how do we actually construct this shell code. And this is rather like how we constructed the little bit of code we made for Tricky. And we have the same sort of things. So it's like virus code, you want it to work in any executable. We're going to be at some random address on the stack. We can't do any linking. We need to not depend on exact memory addresses, or if we do, we need to carefully encode them in our program, in our shell code. We're probably not going to call library functions by name, unless we know exactly where they are in the target executable, which maybe we could do. But usually, we're going to try to write this in a way where we don't depend on library functions. And we probably need to somehow exit the application when we're done, or assume that that's going to happen, because if we did a buffer overflow, we probably messed up something else on the stack. Like if we wrote past here, we almost certainly messed up something else. We probably don't have the application in a state where we can figure out how to return to what was previously in this return address slot here. We don't, unless we could guess what that is. So most likely we're going to exit the application when we're done. If we don't want to do that, we need to figure out how to go back to what we were doing before, even though we've overwritten part of the data the application would usually use to do that, at least the return address to know what function it was supposed to go back to. But most commonly, attackers just exit the application. Yeah. So the question, isn't it really obvious when your program does this? So exiting the application doesn't mean you make it obvious. I guess several ways this manifests. So in a server, you often will have something which just restarts the server anyways, because you don't want it to go down. And in any case, the exit in the application will just look like a crash, which users usually do not interpret as, oh my god, I'm infected. Like when your browser crashes, you don't think that someone just did something bad on my machine. And if you're more clever, you can exit and restart the application yourself. You can start a new copy and exit the old copy. You can do something like that to clean up your tracks or something like that. That might be easier than actually recovering the state of the program. The main targets are generally things which are automated, so it doesn't really matter if it's noticed, if it's noticeable because of the crash, because it's probably not going to be noticed soon enough. But yes, people do try to sometimes hide it if they really care. Okay, so if you recall, for the Tricky assignment, we gave you some virus code. And this is an example of how the sort of things you have to do when writing shell code. So this code, we have this LEA instruction here, which I'm using this %RIP form. And that's so in the instruction, we have this offset encoded. And it's an offset from the instruction. So we don't need to change this machine code depending on what address on the stack it ends up on. So if you did a normal LEA, there would be an actual stack address you'd try to encode here. And you'd actually get into trouble because you can't encode that in 4 bytes. So you need to use a funny thing that can deal with more than 4 bytes in an address, which is not LEA, actually. But here, we carefully use this thing, which depends on the address of this code, so it's relocatable. We don't care where the buffer ends up. We don't need to rewrite our shell code for every exploit to encode the new address in there. The only address we need to change is that return address that we overwrite. And then we had in this code, we had a push of a constant, which we happen to know was the address of puts. So this is an option you could have for calling a function from shellcode. But of course, you actually have to know what the exact address of that is. That's kind of inconvenient. And It's something which is going to change even more often than what the stack layout is between different versions of the same program. This is now actually something we want to do. But this is encodes that fixed address as a constant. It's not relative to the current instruction like a call instruction would be. And then ret has a fixed encoding. So this doesn't actually work as shellcode, even if it happens to be the case that putS is at the right address. So even if we know where putS is, this is not correct shellcode. So what? Can anyone see what the problem is? It's pretty subtle. Yeah. So the question is, do you have to know what is an RIP? So RIP is a name for the program counter register. Yes, it's not something you often see, but that's what it's a name for. And this is a special syntax for where string is relative to this instruction. So the first problem is that this is an LEAL. So it's into EDI. It's loading a 32-bit value. And our typical stack addresses on 64 bits are going to be bigger than 32 bits. So this actually will not work if you put it on the stack. It's going to truncate the address to 32 bits, and you'll have a problem. So you actually need LEAQ, which differs in the encoding by this prefix byte, which is going to say, this is a 64-bit instruction, not a 32-bit one. Now, we still have one other problem that we really don't like, is that we have this hard-coded address here of putS. We really don't want to do that. We don't want to have to depend on exactly where putS ends up. And more generally, we don't want to depend on putS even being somewhere in the application. We just want something that works in any program. And we can do that by basically copying the implementation of putS into the shellcode. Not the full real one, but a simplified one. Where we're not going to use a call to a library, but we're going to directly call the operating system. So that's a common thing you'll see in shellcode. So here is a way to directly call the write system call, which happens to be done with this syscall instruction. So this is a special instruction which makes a request to the OS. And the OS has a particular thing it expects in registers, which we're setting up here. I'm not going to tell you how they're set up, except on assignments I will like give you an example for system calls you might use. But this is typically what you'll see shellcode do. It won't make a library call. It will actually call the operating system directly. And the reason it's doing this is that it doesn't know where the libraries are. Maybe the exploit writer could do that, but they'd rather just do this once and have it work in all applications. So this code here, I can use in any application I'm doing a buffer overflow on, and it will actually work out fine. And so this makes the encoding a bit different. We have a syscall, but this is the bytes we'd actually put in our buffer. It's the encoding of these instructions, followed by the string. And then we make the jump go to the beginning of this LEA. And I mentioned that we want to exit, so we can also do that. So we can add an exit, call the system request to the operating system to have our program exit. So we can actually cleanly exit, so it just looks like whatever we're running terminated normally for some reason. Okay, so that's the part where we construct code that we want to run. So the second step is inserting the return address value in the right place. And this is the thing that we're not going to be able to make work on every single application. We're going to have to do something that's kind of application specific. So there are two basic strategies. You can examine the target executable's disassembly and figure out how much is allocated on the stack. You look at what manipulates the stack pointer, how much is subtracted, where is the buffer passed to this function, what part of the stack is that in, and figure out what the stack layout is. And this is what people will do. So a skill you should expect to do, a reason we had the RE assignment is having that sort of practice looking at assembly code, because if you want to figure out what's on the stack, you better be able to do that sort of reading of assembly code to figure out where values are. Another option would be that maybe you could guess where things are. And there's two things we need to know. We need to know what the address of the buffer is and where the return address is relative to the buffer. And some of these might be easier than others. So knowing where things are relative to the buffer is actually something you can probably guess. And the reason you can probably guess it is that if the buffer is 100 bytes, there's not too many possibilities that are reasonable. Like, yes, the compiler allocated 20 bytes of extra space in that case, but it's unlikely the compiler is going to allocate more than like 30 or 40 bytes. So there's only like, you know, like four or five plausible possibilities. Yeah. So that would be another reason it would be in a different place. So as long as, so the question is, what if the function already did stuff on the stack? Isn't this a problem? So as long as what the function has done with the stack doesn't stop it from returning to the address we specify, we're fine. So even if we've messed up all these saved values on the stack, as long as the function still gets to that return and reads our return address that we overwrote, we're still going to get what we want. It doesn't matter that we completely messed up the program state, because we aren't going to go back to the program. We ended our shell code with an exit call. And that's one of the reasons why, most likely. Yeah?
Can you write nops that just nops up to the return address that you've played, so you have like a little bit of a wiggle room?
So we will get to that. So the question is, can you just put nops so you have wiggle room? And that's something you can do. So for guessing the location of the return address, we actually need to know that. Inserting nops won't help us. So, but for guessing the location of the return address, we can there's only so many possibilities. So you probably can actually guess if you know how big the buffer is. You don't, you, to really know, you look at the machine code and disassemble it and look at what gets pushed on the stack. But if you look at the C code, you can say, oh, there's a 1,000-byte buffer. It's probably 1,000 plus a small number. I can just try a bunch of numbers until I get the result I want. Yeah? So the question is, when you overwrite the buffer, is the machine code somewhere close to the return address? So yes, it is. But that fact doesn't help you figure out what the address of the machine code is. Because it's you know from where you put the return address what the relative location, what the difference is between the buffer and the return address. You don't know what the address of either of them are. And you do need to know that address to set the return address correctly.
So even if the machine code is right next to the return address that you're going to overwrite, you still have to just figure out the location.
So the question is, even if the machine code you write is right next to the return address, you still need to figure out the location? Yes. Just because in all the calling conventions we've learned, what's stored there is not a relative difference from the location of the address, but the absolute address. And that makes sense, because it wouldn't really make sense for call to write something to the stack that's the difference between the address of the next instruction and the stack pointer. We could imagine an architecture which does that, but there's no reason to do it. So, as I said, guessing. So, the hard thing to guess is going to be the actual address of the buffer. The easy thing, but we have some leeway. So we can do what was described earlier, which is that let's put some no-ops. We can say, here's our shell code, let's say, which happens to execute a shell somewhere. And here's our easier to guess shell code. So I've just put a bunch of no-ops at the beginning. And this way, I can be less precise. So I write a return address, and I have some idea where it is, so I have to know something about the stack. But I can, if I get anywhere in that string of no-ops, I'm good. I write a whole bunch of no-ops as the beginning of the buffer, and then I write my machine code, and then I put my return address in there. And as long as I have some idea roughly where the buffer is, I'm good. So if I know where the stack starts, this means I can probably actually guess that address well enough. Or at least guess with a few tries. You know, because I have, you know, depending on how many nops I have, I might have like plus or minus 40 I can be off. That means I don't have to make that many guesses. So combined with being able to write machine code that works in any application, this means that you can actually do stack smashing blind. If you know where the stack typically starts on that platform, and it starts in a consistent place, you can just say, I'm going to guess how much stuff is above in the stack, and you can be off by like 100 each time. You can guess how much is beyond the buffer. You can write multiple copies of return addresses you're trying. So you can write a return address here, and one here, and one here. You can write one below the machine, below the real where the real location is. You can try multiple things at once. And you can actually do this just with guessing without even knowing what the code machine code looks like. So yes, it would be better to have the machine code and a copy to try it on, but this technique is generic enough that you can make this work pretty consistently without knowing exactly how the code compiles to. So does that make sense? Questions? Yeah. Yeah, because increasing addresses. So execution goes this way because that's where the way addresses go. Yes.
How do you know like where to start looking on the stack but not know exactly where something is on the stack?
So the question is, how would you know where to start looking on the stack but not know exactly where something is? So the primary way is that many systems, at least historically, have started their stack in every application at the same point. So what you're guessing is not like what's the location of the stack, you're guessing how much stuff did the application do in the stack before it called this function. And that's something you can like make an educated guess looking at the C code. You can say how many functions were called, how much stuff do they allocate, and you can make a reasonable guess that way. And if you have a big buffer, in fact, you don't have many possibilities. So if you can, so here I'm saying like we have like 80 bytes of nops. In some real cases of this, you might have like multiple kilobytes of nops, in which case you can be very imprecise. And if you can guess that this function is the only thing which made significant stack allocations and you know where the stack started, it's hard to get it wrong even. Yeah. So the question is, if I open up Word, how are we going to stack smash Word? So the thing you need to find is some input which you can put too much stuff in, and then you need to find some way of inputting all this machine code and the return address as part of that, which maybe you can't do from the keyboard, but you certainly could do from a file. But that is a bit of an issue, right? How do you input this stuff? So the case I gave you earlier was connecting to something on the network and sending something. You can send arbitrary bytes. That's easy. But you might say, isn't this something that the program won't accept? Because this contains all sorts of weird stuff, like null bytes and machine code, which isn't printable characters. And I gave you an example with scanf. Scanf with %s is reading a word, like an English word, is what it's meant to read. Can I really put machine code in that and a return address? Yeah. So yeah, so the question is, wouldn't it just not know? And if you look at the documentation, what this does is it matches a sequence of non-white space characters. So I can't just put anything, but I need to avoid space, tab, and a few other white space characters that exist in ASCII. So as long as my address that I need to write it down and my machine code doesn't contain any of these, I'm fine. And it happens that it doesn't. And notice that this list doesn't actually contain \0. That's a bit weird, but scanf will happily read null characters and copy them into the string even though the thing calling scanf has no way of knowing that that's there. Go figure. That's really convenient because our machine code and our and the stack address we want contain lots of backslash zeros. Yeah.
Isn't backslash zero,
does that tell it to stop reading, or is that like? So the question, doesn't backslash zero tell it to stop reading? So strings in C are terminated with a null character. And scanf, when you read in the string, will add a null terminator to the end. But when it's reading in stuff from the reading characters from input, it doesn't say, oh, I read in the null character, I'm done. It says, I haven't read in one of these spaces, I'm not done. And it just happily copies that character, not paying attention to the fact that the program calling scanf is not going to know where the string ends. What?
And the program that it's like using will look for the null character. So like if that's in like the middle of the string, that's totally fine.
Yeah, so the program that it's using will look for the null character, which means that in fact that you can make a buffer overflow input for this, which makes the rest of the function behave perfectly normally until the return. Because it will see a normal string and then there's some stuff at the end that it doesn't see as part of the string. Yes. So the person who, so the question is, would the virus writer call the scanner? The person who's calling the scanner is the author of our vulnerable code. So remember, this was our vulnerable code. So this was written by the good guys. The good guys just decided, you know, no one's ever gonna write more than 100 characters, I'm fine. So that's where the copying is happening. It's done for us. And there's lots of ways that this can happen. There are a bunch of functions you probably shouldn't use, like scanf with %s is an example. And there's other functions where you're not checking the length. You're just assuming that you're good enough. And it just happens that it works, that it will happily copy the machine code you want. So you might say, you know, it's kind of silly that scanf will copy null characters. Isn't that really a problem? And the answer is no. And you'll commonly see that shellcode is written to make sure that this works fine. So here's a version of my shellcode, which when we assemble it, will not contain any zero bytes. So I needed to do a bunch of weird stuff. So one thing you might see is that we have this jump, and I put the string before I read its address. The reason I did that is because this LEA instruction contains an offset from the address that's in fact a signed offset. And it's a 4-byte offset, so I wanted not to contain any 0 bytes. And the way I do that is by making it negative, so it's all basically ones. So this offset is going to be negative some, like negative 40 bytes or something like that. The other thing is that I had these moves to set up the system call where I set EDX and EAX. And I was moving using move L, which moved a 4-byte constant, which was stored usually with some leading 0 bytes because I'm using 1 and 37. And I don't want any 0 bytes in the machine code, so I use move B, which stores a 1-byte constant, after using XOR to set the rest of the bytes of the register to 0. And so, yeah, so as I said, for this jump, is so this encoding is, this is the offset that's encoded. It's negative 44, which doesn't contain any 0 bytes. So if we encode this, we actually get something where if you look at the machine code, it contains no 0 bytes. I also got rid of the backslash 0 at the end of the string, because I'm using a system call where I actually, really? pass a length to the system call, so I don't need the backslash 0 to terminate the string. I'm not using putS. And sorry about that. Yeah, okay. So this 25 here is the length of, this hex 25 is the length of the string, so I don't need a backslash zero. Yeah. So the reason I'm talking about how you do this is because not all our buffer overflows are going to look like that scanf. And I wanted to show you that, you know, it's not just the case that scanf people were sloppy and shouldn't have allowed backslash zeros, which no one wanted anyways. Like that you have this problem even if the buffer overflows in something which respects backslash zero. Like if I string copied something after I scanf'd it, I'd still have this problem because I can still construct this machine code. And the address, I can just write the leading parts without the zeros at the beginning. That's fine. Because commonly people have suggested that maybe input filtering is the solution to this problem. And this shows you that input filtering doesn't really work that well. Yeah?
So instead of nops, can you use just like increment one or something, or like increment a register, and just like have it do some meaningless operation?
So the question is, instead of no ops, could I like increment or decrement? Yes. There's not a reason we have yet to get rid of nops, because nops were not zeros. They're encoded as a single byte nop is 90 hex, which is something that scanf will happily copy. Or even like string copy will happily copy. Yeah.
So you're saying input filtering isn't a fix, but if you just checked the actual size of the input.
So checking the size of the input is a fix. But filtering the input for these weird machine code stuff doesn't really work. And it seems like here that maybe it would work, but we don't check for zeros. We check for just non-printable stuff, right? We have some 05. That's not a real character in ASCII if you look it up. It's a control code. Not something we expect in any user input. So you might say we can just check for other input, and we can do this in a more generic way, like without modifying our code to pass the lengths of buffers. But that doesn't work. So I showed you how to carefully get rid of zeros from machine code. And in fact, with a lot more cleverness, you can get rid of pretty much anything you want from machine code. So in x86, you can write pretty much anything with just printable ASCII characters. Here's some useful opcodes. You can do XOR on various registers. You can do increment, decrement, push, and pop on various registers. You can push a one-byte constant, and you can do conditional jumps. And using this with a lot of cleverness, you can construct code that does anything. Note that the advanced version of this technique is that you write machine code to the stack using this other machine code and then jump to it, which means you really can do anything. So this is enough to do anything because you can like store zero in a register, increment it a bunch of times, push to the stack, store something else in a register, then jump, use a conditional jump to you know where on the stack it is relative to your shell code, and then run it.
So until they just decided to change the opcode to something
So the question is, if Intel didn't have opcodes which were convenient like this, you could just filter it? Probably. But no one designs instruction sets that way. There's no reason to. But there is an actual problem, which maybe it's hard to overwrite the address correctly in something that's all normal ASCII. So maybe the filtering would kind of help there. But this sort of flexibility is also helpful in other exploits. I'd just like to point out that, you know, maybe that this is not, that needing to put machine code, this weird arbitrary binary data, is less of a restriction than you think. The stuff where we have to put the actual address in there, that's more of a restriction because we have less flexibility as to what that is. But machine code, we can make it be pretty much any form we want and still have it do whatever we want. So that shows you sort of the technique for Stack Overflow. I'd like to talk about things other than stack smashing briefly, which is that not all buffer overflows on the stack are going to be things where we're going to do the stack smashing stuff. And I'll start with the simple thing. So let's say we have this code where we call, where we use getS. getS is a function which reads a line into a buffer. You notice I don't tell how big the buffer is, so it can overflow. If I do this, I have an easy exploit, assuming that both score and buffer are stored in the stack. They're stored in the stack in the right order. I can just overwrite score directly. I don't need to fiddle with return addresses and machine code. I can just do it. Now, it might be laid out in the stack like this. I just write over the end of the buffer, I set the score to whatever I want. So I'd like to point out that the world is not stack smashing. And there's going to be whole families of exploits which use things other than the return address. We talk a lot about the return address because it's very powerful. It lets us not just change a score in this case, but execute arbitrary code. And because it's very generic. As I told you, you can even guess that, oh, this is overflowing on the stack. You can make, knowing that, you can guess how to exploit it even without reading the machine code. But this is also exploitable. So if I input 103 A's, I'm going to set my score to this big number. So, and this is the sort of the first type of many, many weird overflow, weird ways of exploiting buffer overflows we're going to talk about. Like, well, no, the, yeah, there's not just return addresses we worry about. So in this case, I also could overwrite this return address, but it sure is a lot easier to just overwrite the score rather than overwriting the return address and writing machine code that does exactly what I want. It's probably a lot easier to just overwrite the score if I know that this is what's going on. And I'd like to give a general note about buffer overflows is that, as we'll learn later, so we've seen one technique, which is stack smashing. But there are other things where there are other things you can find on the stack that you can overwrite and do something useful. Some of them are very application specific. Like here, score we happen to know is useful to overwrite. But there are other things which are not not which are other cases which are also going to be very useful and maybe less application specific. And this means that we're going to talk about things which avoid stack smashing, but since we're not solving the original problem of buffer overflows, that doesn't mean just because we can't do stack smashing that we can't exploit it. And the pattern we'll see for the next several weeks is that pretty much any time you have a buffer overflow of any kind, no matter how minor, there's probably a circumstance under which an attacker can run arbitrary code using that. Like off by one error, there are real cases of real exploits of off by one errors where you can overwrite a buffer by one byte, and that turns into arbitrary code execution. So it's not the case that you're just safe. Okay, and in our last 5 minutes, let's look at some actual history. So this is disassembled and reconstructed code from the Morris worm for its buffer overflow. So what they do is they initialize a buffer with a bunch of zeros, then a bunch of ones for some reason, and then they write their shell code, which they've helpfully constructed here, which is this big binary string. That's the machine code for their target platform. And then they write the things they want on the stack. They set up a little more than the return address because I think they need the frame pointer to work correctly. So they like write a frame pointer and a return address to the stack that's specially constructed so there is a pointer to where this machine code ends up. So that's in this buffer, so this is going to get written to the stack when the program runs. And because they're writing things past the end of the buffer, here, past the end of the 512 bytes that they're expecting to read, so they're writing at address 556, 560, and 564, other things on the stack, they're going to get the result they want of actually changing what the return value ends up being. And then they send it to the server, and then they send a new line because the server reads until a new line. Yeah? So this is the buffer in the exploiting application. So that buffer is big enough. So the buffer in our application is the correct size. The buffer in the target application is 512 bytes. So all this stuff here is stuff that in the target application is going to end up past the end of its buffer on the stack. For us, we've allocated enough memory because we know what we're doing. So the first trick was that Morris needed to look at what was on the stack carefully in order to set these values such that that set the return address. And I think in this case, you need to set the frame pointer to point to the return address because it like popped into RSP something and then return based on that. But you just set that up based on knowing what was on the stack in this function. And one of these is a pointer to the location of the buffer. And I'm guessing that this one is a no-op sled. Probably on VAX, ones were no-ops. Instruct opcode one was a no-op. So that's a no-op sled, so it could be imprecise. And the actual shellcode here, this is the shellcode. This is VAX assembly, so I do not expect you to know it. But what he's doing is he's pushing a constant, which is the end of the string. He's pushing bin sh onto the stack, the string, with two push instructions. And bin sh is the name of the shell, the command line program. Pushes that on the stack and puts the address of that into register 10, which happens to be used for system calls. Then he pushes a bunch of stuff on the stack for the system call. I'm sorry, so register 10 isn't used for system calls, but he pushes it onto the stack. So he's setting up a system call here where the arguments are 3 and the address of this string bin sh and 0 and 0. So that's a system call and then runs the special instruction to run a system call. That's what this shellcode does. And it happens that system call replaces the current program with the shell. So it does double duty. It both exits the program and runs the shell, which is convenient. And this is the machine code that's embedded in here. That's why you see /bin and /sh readable parts. So that's our example of a real one. Yeah. So it replaces the program with the shell. And an important part about how it does this is that the program's input, the shell's input, is the same as the original program's input. So the original program is reading from its network socket, and it turns out that the shell is also reading from the same network socket to read commands. So after he sends the string, they just send a command to run. And it's now talking to the shell, not the original program, and the shell will happily run that command. Yes?
So instead of doing
send
server
above
and then doing the new line, you would do like right between those two, you would send like something else.
So after the new line.
Oh, after.
So he needs to send the new line because the server is running getS. It's reading until a new line. And we need to, so in that case, so like in our original vulnerable code here, we're running scanf. And we actually need scanf to complete because we're not going to run our malicious code until we return. And the same is true in the function that he's attacking. The function is doing something to read something, and we're overflowing the buffer, overflowing the return address of the function that's calling the read function. So we need the read function to actually return. And the function that was calling it to return, and then our code will run. So we need to send the new line to cause the function that's reading to return, so we'll actually execute that return statement to our machine code.
So then under the new line,
Yeah, so underneath, after that, he like sends a copy of the, like cat to file copy of the virus, of the worm, etc. So our basic procedure, and I guess I'm not, for stack smashing, is that our setup is that we have a buffer on the stack, the attacker writes past the end, and overwrites a return address that's somewhere past the end of the buffer on the stack with an address of some part of the buffer. And that some part of the buffer, the attacker makes sure has machine code the attacker wants to run. And the attacker constructs that machine code to make sure that it works in the target executable, generally by making machine code that works anywhere. So that's what stack smashing is. And that's all I have for today. So the next time we have questions for exam review.